Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest this morning is His Holiness Radhana Swami. From his humble beginning, born as Richard Slavin into a middle-class Jewish family in 1950, His Holiness have lived a life that has led him to be one of India's premier spiritual leaders. His Holiness and I will be discussing his road to enlightenment in his new memoir, The Journey Home, and also about his current tour schedule in the United States. Good morning, Your Holiness. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning, sir?
I'm so grateful to be with you, Johnny, and with all of your listeners, and I wish you all a very good morning.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to have you on air with me. I really enjoy reading your book, from the stories about your mom to selling your blood to survive and a learning encounter with a mongoose in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Your book is filled with many wonderful touches of humanness and unconditional love. Let us get started in getting to know you a little bit better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life growing up as a child in the 1950s and 60s.
I was born in 1950 in Chicago, and at the age of four, my family moved to a suburb called Highland Park in Illinois. And I lived a apparently normal childhood, absorbed in studies and sports. But then I became a teenager. It was then the 1960s. And there were so many things that I just didn't understand. It just didn't make sense. Some of my dearest friends that I worked with were African American. And I saw how really they didn't have equal rights. They were looked down upon and usually trapped to live and die in the ghettos. It didn't make sense to me, so I became very much involved in the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King. At the same time, the Vietnam War was raging, and there was a draft, and my friends, brothers, were being drafted and sent to a war that they really didn't believe in. And I was thinking, you know, what really is happening in the world? And I saw persecution in the name of religion, in the name of a God that is love and forgiveness. I saw vengeance and hate. And there were so many questions in my mind. In the beginning, through demonstrations, I joined the counterculture. But as time went on, I came to the conclusion that I had to change myself. I heard the words of Mahatma Gandhi that we have to be the change that we want to see in the world and in other people. And I really wanted to change myself and find who am I in a meaningful and fulfilling life.
When you were growing up, one of the things that in reading your book I got was the fact that somehow, somewhere, you were quite unique. You never did like to sit on a chair. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had certain traits that I didn't understand and my family didn't understand. I don't know if, according to our own philosophy that I understand now, it may have been due to previous lives, but I didn't like anything new. Whenever my parents got me new clothes, I would request my mother to wash them at least 6-7 times till they didn't look new, till I would wear them. Whenever they gave me new shoes, I would scrape them with rocks so they looked old. And there was something in me where I didn't feel comfortable having better things than other people had. I seemed to almost idolize the poor and the downtrodden. Where that came from, that was a mystery. I wouldn't sit on chairs when I would eat. My mother and father, they were so understanding and they were so loving. They always tried to encourage me by their example and by their wise words.
Mm-hmm.
But things I just did on my own, which they really couldn't understand. And I remember sometimes we would go to restaurants and a waitress would offer me a chair and my mother would smile at her and say, "He doesn't believe in chairs."
That's just a wonderful story, and I brought that up because it seems that there was already something in you way back when you were a child. And in your book, you did talk about coming to full circle, which we'll get to in a minute. But I just wanted to bring that up because it was quite interesting to set a base to where we're heading to, because I believe you can't look ahead without knowing where you're at and obviously where you came from. What inspired you to go on this spiritual quest?
As I mentioned, Johnny, there were serious burning issues in the world that
mm-hmm.
I was trying to grasp. And in due course of time, I did believe that I had to change myself. And I wanted to find a fulfilling and meaningful purpose in life that I could be, that I could dedicate myself for. I remember hearing the words that if you do not have an ideal that you're willing to die for, that you really have nothing very meaningful to live for.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to find that ideal, and it became the foundation of my spiritual quest.
What were some of the memorable turning points and crossroads in your life's journey prior to arriving in India?
There were so many, but to mention a few, when I was just a teenager, one of my very best friends, I was supposed to be in the car with him that day, but I happened to be working, and his car skid on ice and fell into Lake Michigan, and he died. He was only about 16 or 17. And it happened so sudden, and it was so close to my heart. I remember wondering, really, who am I, and what is life?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the whole world is skidding on the ice of uncertainty. And I really wanted to find something substantial to hold on to in my life beyond the flickering things that were going on around me. On another occasion, I remember I was on the wrestling team of the Deerfield High School, and I dislocated my shoulder in a champion tournament, and that was a turning point because I had already lost interest in it. I didn't have the courage to give it up, but it seemed like a power beyond my own kind of dislocated that aspect of my life along with my shoulder. And while I was in the hospital, I had just had a surgery, and I was just coming out of anesthesia, and my mother, she was standing right at my bedside, as she always was, and she was smoking a cigarette.
Hmm.
I began to cough, and I said to her, "You know, Mother, your cigarette's making me sick." And I remember seeing tears well in her eyes. And she quickly put out her cigarette, and as she patted my head, she said, "If my smoking is hurting you, then I promise you I'll never smoke again." And that was the last cigarette she ever smoked in her life. And in such instances like this, I found how a person could give up. She was smoking two packs of cigarettes for about 15 years before that day.
Wow.
How for a higher principle, the principle of unconditional love, one can give up things that are so close to them for that reason. And that sacrifice that she made was deeply impressed within my heart, and it did help me to understand. And as the years went on, in fact, even to this day, I'm still understanding in deeper and deeper proportions the symbolism of what she did.
Mm-hmm.
She was willing to sacrifice something that was such a part of her life for a higher principle. And that mm-hmm. higher principle was the principle of being compassionate, of unconditional love,
mm-hmm.
love the mother. And that very deeply affected my whole life.
That's an amazing story, because I think we don't talk about it very much, about motherly love and fatherly love, because we take it for granted, because we're so close to the situation. But having you brought that up in your book, and I've read it, it was just amazing, because to give up cigarettes, and especially smoking 2 packs a day, and of course now we know that science shows that there is an addiction to it because of the chemicals in it, and her having to overcome that, quite literally just switching the switch off, so to speak. That was just a tremendous thing that she did.
Yeah, another symbol of that, Johnny, is
mm-hmm.
she didn't even know that cigarettes were bad for health in those days.
Right.
She did it out of love for her child.
Mm-hmm.
But in making that sacrifice, she also saved her own health and maybe her own life.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that is very symbolic, that when we do extend ourselves unconditionally to help others, we also benefit so greatly.
Very true. It sort of takes us to the next level of our own self, and which I think is just tremendous. Well, you have traveled extensively from then on, when you went over to Europe with your friends, traveling around, searching for a lot of things. Prior to arriving in India, what have you learned along the way that helped you better understand what were you seeking in India?
Well, when myself and my friend Gary set out on our journey, we really didn't have any money. We just took a summer trip to Europe to between college semesters. But gradually our spiritual yearnings were deepening and growing. And it ended up that I chose to leave my friend Gary to hitchhike to India. And along the way, so many things happened that were so life-transforming. The 6 months that it took hitchhiking between London and India, I probably aged about 30 years through the experiences.
Wow.
There were dens of thieves that tried to murder me, trapped me in a room. There were diseases that I was getting that I could never even conceive of, you know, growing up in the suburbs of Chicago. I remember one time in Kandahar, Afghanistan. This was in 1970. I was sitting in a tea stall. And these people were the poorest people I've ever seen in my life economically.
Mm-hmm.
There were about 5 or 6 of us just squatting down on a dirt floor in a little wooden shack. And a little boy, perhaps about 16, came in. He was emaciated thin. He was wearing soiled rags. But what really shocked me was his eyes were grossly disfigured and blinded. And there was nothing covering them, and I had never seen anything like that before. My senses quaked seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a one-stringed instrument. It was just a branch of a tree with a little can, a tin can, and a wire strung across it, nailed on both sides. He started plucking that wire and singing religious songs. And he went into a trance as he was singing. His face illuminated. His mouth was smiling in a type of ecstasy. And the 6 of us just sat there mesmerized for probably a half hour hearing him sing. And I remember this was really a culture shock, because the way I grew up, health and wealth and position were what would bring us happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And this boy had nothing. He had no health. He had no education. He was illiterate. And he had nothing financially. But yet he was rejoicing in his love of God. And I was thinking, really, what is happiness? Happiness is something, if we can find it within, we can find it anywhere and in any situation. And if we can't find it within ourselves, we can't really find it anywhere in this world.
Very interesting. Now, you guys were also musicians, especially for yourself. And this, again, is part of the things that you have learned that you never knew what that would lead you until much later in life. Tell us a little bit about that, some of the things that you went through briefly there in Europe as a musician to make a living.
Well, when Gary and I were traveling in Europe, you know, at one time we really had no money from the very beginning, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But we could sleep in parks or in crash pads, or, you know, we found places. But when we came to Greece, the government was very strict in those days, and any type of vagrancy, you know, we would be put in prison. So we understood we had to somehow or other get some money for the youth hostel, so we did what was traditional for down-and-out travelers in those days. We donated blood at the blood bank. And in that, it was quite a painful ordeal, the procedures that were done in Greece back in 1970. And we were sitting and waiting for whatever little money we're going to get. And we happened to see somebody with a guitar case from France and someone from Switzerland with a violin case. And they were in the same agony as us. And I, in those days, played the harmonica. So we all looked at each other and decided, let's start a band. So we started playing in the streets of Athens, and Gary would hold the little hat out, and people would throw the drachmas, which was the currency in those days, into the hat.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be very, very popular. Several days went, and the hat just kept filling up and filling up and filling up. Until one day, we found ourselves surrounded by police with machine guns who took us to prison. And they didn't actually put us in jail. They took us to the station and took our money and said, if you ever do this again, then you will be in prison. So that was kind of the beginning and the end of my professional musical career. But I did find, while hitchhiking on the side of the road, a very intimate friend of mine was that harmonica who I could reveal the innermost longings and joys and sorrows of my heart. And he would translate it into a music that touched people's hearts, and I was so grateful for that.
Wonderful. That's a beautiful story. That's why I'm asking you about that. Now, you had pretty much sort of a revelation also in Greece, didn't you? Please share that with us.
Gary and I, with whatever money we hid from the police, we took a boat to the island of Crete. And there, my spiritual yearning was really like a raging fire within me. And I would go, we lived in a cave, and every day I would climb a mountain. On the top of that mountain, I would meditate and pray and read spiritual books from various traditions from sunrise to sunset. And Gary would be on the seashore doing the same thing. And every evening we would meet in the cave and discuss our realizations and our experiences. One day, I was yearning so deeply for direction. I remember I was weeping tears and praying to God, please give me direction in my spiritual path. And just as the sun was setting over the Mediterranean Sea, beautiful sunset, I heard a voice within my heart. It was silent, but in that silence it was so loud that it changed my whole life. I heard three words, go to India. I never met an Indian before in my life. I never ate Indian food. I didn't know where India was, and I didn't have a map, and I had no money. Mm-hmm. But I was determined to go. So I returned to the cave, and Gary was sitting in meditation with a little candle at his side. And then he turned to me, and he said, "Something amazing happened to me today." I said, "What?" Gary said, "At sunset, I heard a voice." I said, "What did the voice say?" He said, "You may not believe me." I said, "Gary, I might believe you. What did he say?" He said, "I heard the words, go to Israel." Mm-hmm. I slid myself closer and said, "Where?" He said, "I told you you wouldn't believe me." I said, "No, I believe you, but I didn't hear you. Where?" He said, "Israel." I said, "Well, I was told to go to India." There was complete silence as I looked up at the stars over the Mediterranean Sea, and I remember whispering into the heavens, "Yes, I'm willing." And then I broke the silence and told Gary that I have to leave tomorrow morning because I feel that this is a calling of God. And he tried to dissuade me, telling me it's very dangerous hitchhiking through the Middle East and the deserts, and better we go to Israel together and make money, and then we'll take a bus together to India. But this calling was so deeply affecting my heart, I really felt I had to go immediately. So the next morning I left my dear lifelong friend all alone on this island, and I began hitchhiking. And I believed if I just kept hitchhiking in the eastern direction, someday, by God's grace, I would arrive in India.
It's a fabulous story. And your path with him would cross again in India. And do tell us a little bit about that, because you have some wonderful, fascinating stories and some trials and tribulations that you went through once you get to India.
Should I speak of the trials and tribulations or about Gary?
I guess a combination of both, because of the trials and tribulations, and then you kind of ran back into Gary, I believe.
Well, hitchhiking to India was quite an ordeal. It took me 3 months from Istanbul to the border. And as I said, there were life-threatening challenges. You brought up the one incident when I was in Afghanistan. It was also in Kandahar. I was on the roof of a wealthy man, and there I was speaking to him, and a mongoose crawled up the back of my shirt, and I had long hair because I was part of the counterculture at the time, and the mongoose made a nest out of my hair and went to sleep on the back of my neck, and he was really heavy, and I asked my host, "Please take him off." And he said that there is a saying, never wake a sleeping mongoose. The mongoose is so ferocious when it's angry that it can even kill the cobra, the symbol of death. So don't move at all and wait till he leaves on his own. Anyways, he slept there for about 6 hours, and it felt like a time bomb on my head. I didn't know what was going to happen, and he was very heavy, and my host had to go to sleep because he was so tired. So I was sitting there on the rooftop in the moonlight trying to make sense of it. And my mind was at one time tormented, and then I started to think that every situation is an opportunity to either shrink or grow, according to how we interpret it. So maybe there's something I'm supposed to learn here. Rather than just hating the situation, why not just be open to what I can learn? And I came to the inspiration that what this mongoose in this situation is teaching me is patience, trying to see a positive opportunity in whatever situation we're in life. And once I adjusted my mind in that way, even though the pain and the danger was the same, I was feeling gratitude and I was feeling inner fulfillment. And that patience was so much necessary to prepare me for what was about to come on my journey. Anyways, many things happened in the Middle East, and when I finally came to India, I walked about 20 kilometers between Pakistan and India and finally came to the Indian border post. It was in a forest, and I was so much eager. Finally, I'm just steps away from the destination I've been called to, and the immigration agent would not allow me in. She said I needed $200 to enter the country. I pleaded and I begged, but she would not let me in. At one point, she had her guards with guns, you know, make me go back. And I just sat under a tree and prayed, and finally the guards changed, and I went to the new guard, who was a Sikh gentleman, and I begged and pleaded with him, and he also refused me. And I remember saying, just give me a chance, and I promise someday I'll do something good for your people. You don't know what I've gone through to come to see your people and to understand your culture. And he looked at me and said, sometimes a man must follow his heart. I have been ordered by my superior officer to refuse you, but I'm going to give you that chance that you're begging for. Then he stamped my passport and put his hand on his head, on my head, and said, I bless you, my child, that you find what you're crying for. Welcome to India. And then I traveled in the Himalayas and lived as a wandering spiritual hermit and met many spiritual people. Some are very, very famous in the world today. Some the world does not know of. I lived in jungles and caves and holy places, and I became a very seasoned traveling wanderer seeking truth. And eventually, about a year later, I was in Nepal, and I was walking through a massive rice paddy, and I saw rains were beginning to form. And the monsoon season, I knew what type of torrential rains there were. So I looked for shelter, and there were no trees, there were no houses, just rice paddies. And for those of you who have been in rice paddies, they're in the monsoons, they're very muddy and deep. But there's just a little border of about a foot wide that goes around the rice paddy. And I was walking on one of those, and I happened to see what appeared to be a little old man under an umbrella walking maybe about 100 yards in front of me. So I was running and slipping on this little border, and somehow or other I got to him, and I just nuzzled myself as close as possible to him as he was walking from his backside under the umbrella. And we walked about 20 minutes together, and he never turned around because, you know, turning around would mean, you know, maybe slipping into the rice pit. So after the rain subsided, I thanked the person, and he turned around and looked at me and literally was so shocked, he dropped his umbrella right into the mud of the rice paddy. And he looked at me and cried out my name, and I looked at him and cried out, Gary. It was my friend Gary. We were the only two people in this massive rice paddy. And we walked together under the same umbrella for about 20 minutes. And we were reunited after about a year of absolutely no communication.
It's just a beautiful story, and I wanted you to share that because it's amazing things happen in our lives that it's been chartered out in some ways. If we let ourselves go in terms of following that, you never know what you may encounter. It's just fascinating. Well, how did your parents react to all the decisions you've made, and especially, of course, heading to India and staying in India for a while?
That was one of the most difficult decisions in that time, part of my life, because my mother and father were such totally loyal, faithful, and caring parents. And they gave me so much. Being a teenager in the 1960s, I regret that I really didn't appreciate it because there was such a challenge to the older generation, and there was almost a war between the generations in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother and father always were so caring and so loving and so open and understanding, and we always had a very beautiful, respectful relationship. But I had to follow my own calling. And after that calling in Greece that I just spoke about,
mm-hmm.
to go to India, it was at that time that I was supposed to return home to continue college. And I knew if I didn't, it would break my parents' heart. And I didn't know how to explain it to them. So I just went on hitchhiking, and I was supposed to be back in 2.5 months, and 3 months passed, and 3.5 months passed, and 4 months passed, and they heard nothing from their son. And I was in my heart knowing how much they must be suffering, and I didn't want them to suffer, but I didn't know how to explain it. Finally, they received a letter that explained that I'm no longer with Gary, that I decided that I was going to hitchhike to India to see how people of the East view life, view society, and view God.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that this was an education that was more important to me than going back to college. The end of the letter, I said something I knew that they wouldn't be able to follow. I said, please, I don't do this to hurt you. I do this because it's the calling of my life. Please do not worry about me.
Mm-hmm.
The letter was postmarked Iran, and it had no return address.
What's interesting about the story is that two things. Number one is that had you made the journey today, now, in this generation or this time, well, we can basically get away because we got all the electronic gadgets from cell phones to computers and everything else. But at that time, the mode of communication is letter writing. And you're right, because not knowing what the reaction would be until the letter gets home, and then, of course, if they chose to write to you, which they can't, in the event if they could, then you have to wait another 2-3 weeks before you get the letter. So communications was just a little bit different back then. And also what's good about it gives us a chance to ponder, I think, before we sort of get back off the cuff and just say whatever we wanted to say. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And the other thing, in reading your book, what's fascinating to me is that you were able to study the different religions. You had a wonderful person that shared with you about Christianity, the wonderful person that shared with you about Islam, and of course your Jewish background. You, as a child, spent a tremendous amount of time learning about that, and here you are pretty much a learned person traveling and seeking knowledge that perhaps not many people in this world are really interested in pursuing, and that's quite fascinating. So coming back to you, what is Bhakti Yoga, and how did it help you in your quest?
Yoga is a Sanskrit word which means to reconnect or to reunite. Religion comes from the Latin word religio, which means to bind back. So my understanding is yoga, religion, they really mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
To reconnect or to bind us back to our own essence, to our own life force, our spirit, or to God. And bhakti is the yoga of devotion. It particularly aims at reawakening the dormant love of God that is within the heart of all of us. We have this body, and we have a mind, and the body is compared to a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing through the eyes and tasting through the tongue and hearing through the ears. But who am I? According to the Gita and according to many great saintly people, we are the eternal soul that is the life force that is witnessing life through the body and through the mind. And what is the nature of that life force? It's seeking pleasure. It's our tendency, wherever there's life, whether it's an insect or an animal or a bird or any type of human being, everyone is seeking pleasure and everyone is trying to avoid what interferes with pleasure, which is pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the most fundamental pleasure is the pleasure of love. To love someone and to be loved by someone. Without that, any other pleasures cannot really bring fulfillment to the heart. We're all by nature seeking love, and Bhakti Yoga teaches us that the origin is of that tendency is our inherent love for God and the ability to see the presence of a part of God in every living being and be an instrument of love toward everyone. And Bhakti Yoga really is very much the essence of all the great spiritual paths. That's the way I've understood it. The mm-hmm. awakening of that dormant love and compassion that is within us and is the inherent nature of our eternal soul. And the way we try to awaken that love is through acts of devotion, mm-hmm. through harmonizing whatever duties we may have in this world with that loving need of the soul, by trying to be in the mood of a servant of God and a servant of all living beings in whatever we do.
Mm-hmm.
And also by chanting these mantras or prayers, we help to tune into that love that is within our hearts.
Very interesting. How did His Holiness Prabhupada ended up being your guru?
I met so many different gurus and teachers, and each and every one of them I honored and respected so much. They gave me so much of their love, their kindness, and so much wisdom. When I did meet Srila Prabhupada in Vrindavan, the holy place of Lord Krishna, at that time, I felt that his compassion and his wisdom was everything that I was looking for. I felt in my own life that all that I had learned from all other teachers were so much alive in his wisdom and in his example. And there was something so deep, this concept of love for God in a very personal, intimate way charmed my heart so much that I decided that I wanted to dedicate my life to assisting in being an instrument of the grace that he represented.
Wonderful. At what point in your search did you find the peace, love, happiness, and the understanding you were seeking?
I found little pieces of it everywhere I went. Sometimes it was in the most ghastly situations where I mm-hmm. was in pain or I was struggling or I was suffering or I was about to die. In those situations, I oftentimes found the most peace because I had nowhere else to look to except deep within for it.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's where peace and love and happiness is. When I came to Vrindavan, which is a very holy place that's been for, you know, countless thousands of years, and which is the holy place of Bhakti Yoga, where there's about 5,000 temples and villages and river Jamuna and mountains and forests, that place I felt so permeated with this yoga of devotion. Everyone there was a devotee of Krishna and Krishna's feminine aspect of God, which is Radha.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to cultivate forgiveness and compassion and love was so much in the minds of all the people there. I really felt that this was my home, and I found a great spiritual shelter in that place. And later I was to realize that really that place is within all of us, wherever we may be, if we really turn to God within ourselves.
And that's what you use as the essence for your book. Why did you title your book The Journey Home?
I believe that life is a journey, and everyone in their own way is trying to find their way home. Home is a place of comfort. Home is a place of loving relationships. Home is a place of happiness and peace. And in whatever endeavors a person may be doing, I think everyone's in our journey trying to find that home. But if we don't find it within our own hearts, in our relationship with God, and in our relationships with others on a more spiritual platform, on a more compassionate platform, then we never really find our way home. But if we find it there within ourselves, we can be in the happiness of home in any situation in this world.
Looking back in your journey, was there a particular crossroad you reached to where it could have gone either way in your journey to enlightenment?
I think almost every moment was a crossroads. Because everything that comes upon us in life, we always have free will and a choice to either give up or to move forward. We have a choice to either be angry and criticize a situation or try to understand how to learn and grow in this situation. So there were many, many crossroads. I can't think of any in particular, but that moment in Crete was a serious crossroads where I understood if I follow my calling to hitchhike to India, I would not really be able to. I was leaving behind everything in my life that I knew, and I was going into a whole new quest, and I may never be able to turn back.
Very true. In your journey, you have met many famous gurus that you have mentioned, and also you have communed with the Dalai Lama. How has this contributed to your spiritual vessel?
Particularly the Dalai Lama, when I met him at his headquarters in Dharamshala of the Himalayas of India, I found he was very humorous, very kind, very accommodating in his relationship with myself. What really struck me was how at that time he was under very, very tight security, because people felt that he was, his life was in danger. His house was surrounded by armed guards at the time. And I lived with many of his people in a Tibetan refugee camp, people who had recently been uprooted from their homes. They escaped and they were living in a foreign land. And here was a person who was a refugee, and he was giving his life, his soul, his everything in compassion to his people who were in so much oppression and depression. And I'm thinking that how beautiful this is, that this man has given his life as an act of compassion to his people. And I wanted to capture that spirit in my own life of sacrificing for the welfare of others. I thought that was so beautiful. And it reminded me again of my own mother, who, and I think any good mother sacrifices so much of her own convenience for the sake of a child. And that the closest thing to true unconditional love we can find in this world is the love of a mother for the child. The child may be screaming, may be sick, may keep the mother up all night, maybe the mother has to deal with the excrements, the stool and urine of the child. Actually, the child doesn't appreciate it all. Rather, the child just wants more and more and more, and the mother keeps giving and giving and giving. And that love is what I saw on a larger scale in the Dalai Lama. And it's something that I really felt was the most precious achievement in life, is to really connect with that love on a spiritual platform.
And you have also worked with Mother Teresa. Please share with us your experience with her.
I remember when I was in the ghetto of Calcutta and I met with Mother Teresa. This was in about 1971. She said something to me which really moved me. She said that the most serious problem in this world is hunger. Not hunger of the stomach, but hunger of the heart. It's not that difficult to feed a person's belly with food, but the only thing that will really satisfy the heart is to love and to be loved. And God's love is really the greatest need in the world. And she told me that she travels around the world to Los Angeles, to New York, to Sydney, to Bombay, to London, and she sometimes meets very, very powerful and wealthy people. But she said she feels in their hearts such hunger. And she said the greatest challenge in the world is to feed people with God's love. And that is the highest compassion. Compassion to the body, to the mind, and to the soul. And she lived for that love. She saw her beloved Jesus in the heart of every living being and wanted to feed everyone's heart with the love that she received. And that greatly moved me.
That's an amazing story. Can you please share with us just one lesson we can all learn and practice immediately to help shift us in becoming a better human being?
There's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Gita. And when I first heard this verse, I thought, this is it. This is really what I want to become. And if I may just cite the Sanskrit, it's Vidya Vinaya Sampani, Brahmani Gavihastini, Suni Chaiva Swapaki Cha Pandita Samadarshana. And the translation is, real wisdom, true knowledge, is to see every living being with equal vision, to see that everyone in their heart of hearts, the life force, is sacred. It's a part of God. Whether one is black or white or red or yellow or brown in color, whether one is from the east or from the west, whether one is a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Sikh or a Jain or a Parsi or a Buddhist or an atheist, or even whether one is a cow or an elephant or a dog or a cat, wherever there's life, there's the presence of the spiritual spark, a part of God. And when we realize that's part of God within ourselves through our spiritual practice, then we can recognize that sacred part of God within everyone. And then there's true equality and there's true compassion. We may not like the disease of a person, but if that person is a relative of ours, we still love the diseased within that body. Mm-hmm. And we may not like what people do, but to see that we're all children of God, we're all brothers and sisters, we're all of the same spiritual essence, and to love that essence within each other, I think is all important. Today in the world, because people of religions are so much oriented toward the external forms of their religion, people are, they discriminate. They feel that I'm good and you're bad. And in the same system of faith that is meant to bring about forgiveness and love creates vengeance and hatefulness. And if we actually go to the essence of what real religion is, we find all these great spiritual teachers and teachings are teaching us how to reconnect with God within our own heart and be an instrument of God's love to everyone and everyone in this world. And I think this is the most important lesson, to tune in to our own selves, just like in this radio station, Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
There are many channels that one could tune into on the radio. One channel maybe will access news from London. Another mm-hmm. will access a football game from Dallas. Another mm-hmm. will access the Wall Street updates. And another will access, you know, Johnny's show with the Swami. So according to what frequency we tune into, we access that. So spiritual life really is to tune in and access the divinity and the grace that is within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what prayer is for, and that's what ritual is for, and that's what, in my own faith, we chant this mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Mm-hmm. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This mantra is a mantra that's meant to tune us into the divinity within ourselves. And once we access that, then we can be instruments of that love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing more beautiful and greater than that. What I found in my journey is a true spiritual person is what in Sanskrit is called paradukaduki, one who sees that other people's suffering is their own suffering and other people's happiness is their own happiness.
Very insightful. It's very powerful. Thank you so much, Your Holiness. How has writing this memoir impacted you personally? I know you have gone through a journey, and when you write a book and you start putting all this thing down on paper, it sort of, as you had mentioned, working inside out. So how has this impacted you personally?
Actually, I never wanted to write this book. Many people asked me over the years to do so because they heard some of the stories. But I felt it would be an act of arrogance mm-hmm. to write a book about myself where every page would be filled with the words I and me and mine. And also, I felt that if I really tell the story honestly, mm-hmm. nobody will believe it because it was quite incredible what happened to me on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
When a person puts their life on the line to seek an ideal, it's incredible how things may happen in that person's life, the ups and the downs that are meant to bring us forward. So I kind of put out of my mind the idea of writing a book until about 5 or 6 years ago, one of my best friends who was, he was on his deathbed dying of cancer, and he asked me to stay with him for the last 8 weeks of his life. And one of those days he looked up at me and squeezed my hand and said, please write this book. It will be an act of arrogance for you not to write it if it could give hope and inspiration to people. And your story is a universal story. It's a story of how God took a boy on a search for the same things that everyone's looking for meaning and fulfillment. And if your story can give that hope and inspiration, you should do it. And then he made me promise him on his deathbed. And a few days later, he passed from this world. And I wrote this book. And in writing it, I had to really ponder on things that have happened in the past, in things that really transformed my life. And it was very purifying because I was reliving
mm-hmm.
what changed me to be what I am today, and it helped me to become much more grateful for all the gifts that I had received, and it also helped me to understand that there's just nothing more beautiful than serving others by sharing whatever we have with the world. Even somebody so small and insignificant as myself, we have something to share, and if it can bring hope and inspiration to another person's life, that is the greatest fortune that we can do that for someone else.
It's beautiful. It's very, very true what you just said. Where can someone buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your tour schedule?
The book is at many bookstores. It should be available at many bookstores throughout America. It's also available on Amazon.com, and there's a website, either RadhanathSwami.com or JourneyHomeBook.com, where the book is available and it tells more about it. And it's, what was the second part of the question? Where
your tour schedules and so forth, and I presume that they can find that on the same website too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'll be in Dallas the day after tomorrow. At that time, there's several programs. I don't remember exactly what they are.
I know that they could find those information on your website, and I think you're going to be up in the New York area, either towards the later part of this month, if I'm not mistaken.
I'll be in Dallas for the next few days, and then to Chicago for a few days, and then to New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., and I'll be traveling on this book tour till December, and then I return to where I live in Bombay, India.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for a living we would like to share with our listeners this morning?
It's so beautiful how you conduct your show.
Thank you very much.
Yoga means to harmonize our acts and our words and our thoughts and our life with our higher ideals. And it's important that we keep focused on those higher ideals and not be distracted by the fleeting pressures and the desires and the aversions that will inevitably come our way. And the highest ideal is to harmonize everything we do and say as acts of devotion to God and compassion to others, and to tune in to the great inner wealth that can empower us and inspire us to be so much beyond what we think we are by our spiritual practice.
That's fabulous. Your Holiness, thank you very much for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Blaine Batchelor, an Atlanta-based award-winning author and editor. She has written for Malik Cry, FoxNews.com, USA Today, and Women's Health, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Blaine and I will be talking about her book on being a bachelor. It's a book about real-life experiences laced with humor and advice to today's bachelor. And by the way, you guys heard me right. Bachelor is her last name. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Your Holiness, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you so much, Johnny. It's really a pleasure to be with you and all of your listeners.
Thank you so much.